Johnson and Leslie M. Scott Jones, Charlottesville's only radio show devoted to local arts. And now, here's Leslie.
Good morning, Sunday morning. Whether you are an art... What are you? Whether you're an art maker, an art breaker, an art faker, or an art partaker. What is wrong with this mic? Welcome all, because all are welcome to Homegrown, a show about local art. I'm the one that they call Clinton. And I'm here with your goddess, who is hardly modest, Leslie M. Scott Jones.
Well, good morning, Clinton. How are you?
I am still wondering what's up with this mic. It is not really picking up us as much as it usually does.
Well, what are you worried about that for?
I want people to be able to hear us.
Oh, they can hear us.
Or at least I want them to be able to hear you.
Oh,
I don't care if they hear me.
Oh, my goodness. It's really early on Sunday.
It's because it was really late on Saturday for you.
Yes, it was. But I had such a great time. Actually, I promised I would give a couple of shout outs. So can I do that?
Oh, yeah, go.
Okay. So I need to
shout yourself out.
I need to give a shout out to Champion Brewery and Levi Duncan, Levi Erickson, a few other people I met last night for the first time who were awesome. They did a premiere of this new lemongrass beer, and it was so good. There were so many beers last night, Clinton. There were so many beers. But we had a great time. We had an amazing time, and, you know, I got to hang out with my buddies, you know, and have fun.
Good for you.
That's it? That's all you got to say about that?
No, what I got to say is the Trump-Pence report for today. So tomorrow's the day. In just a number of hours, 538, is that what it is? 538 people are going to go most likely to their state capitals, sit down and vote for the next president. And the indication is that even though at least one person, I think, has stepped down and turned his voting responsibilities over to an alternate, even though some people are thinking of voting for an alternate Republican candidate, I think that there is no question who is going to come out as our next president.
Well, you know, several of the electors can't change their vote. There are only 26 states where electors are allowed to vote for someone different than who was elected.
It's a weird and wacky system.
It is. It's a weird and wacky system.
And it's and this year, I mean, once again, we are awash in that what we are told is an ancient Chinese proverb, may you live in interesting times. Proverb or curse, I don't know, because this is unprecedented. This is unprecedented. What I've read is that, usually this is a perfunctory thing. Usually people don't even think about this step in the election process. I'm sure that there are many Americans who don't even know to this day that there's this step in the election process. But this year, electors have gotten emails. They've gotten phone calls. They've gotten
some of them have gotten death threats.
That's what Fox News says. I haven't heard any other.
No, I saw an interview with a guy. I can't remember what state he was from, but
maybe Arizona.
No, it was middle of the country, kind of high up. Anyway, but he is an elector for one of the states where he can't change his vote. It's a it's a state law over top of the federal law saying that the elector cannot change their vote. So, but he's getting death threats, like 1,200 pieces of mail a day.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Ooh, that's not cool. That's not cool. Death threats are for conservatives to send, not for people left of center. Let's get your idiom right. Okay. white people know what side you're on. I'm just assuming. I don't know. And maybe they're all black death threats.
I don't know.
I can't imagine. I think isn't a black man just walking down the street? Doesn't that doesn't that just constitute a death threat in and of itself?
Apparently, yeah.
That's why. Deadly force. Know it, love it, use it. That's our advice to local police. Remember, deadly force. Know it, love it, use it.
We are so wrong. We're just wrong.
So before you get shot down, here is our artistic nonviolent protest suggestion for the week. If you are heading off to state capitals to make yourself known, to be seen, and to try to intimidate electors, here are my three suggestions for signs for you. One, here's the first suggestion for protest signs for you. Don't make the Electoral College Trump University.
Ooh.
There you go. There you go. Two, Hamilton is watching. Don't throw away your shot. That's really just for us. I don't think Republican electors are listening to Hamilton.
Love that, though. That's great.
And the third one, vote for the country, not for the crazy. There you go. Those are my three suggestions.
Those are very good suggestions. I like all three of those.
Thank you. People work on their signs. I thought I had to step it up to really. There's some really great signage out there. Let's head over to our first guest. Joining us for the first time. Now it is. Joining us for our first time on Homegrown is Jerry Shermer. How are you, Jerry?
I'm doing great this morning, Clinton.
Excellent. Thank you so much for coming and joining us this morning.
My pleasure.
You are the inaugural guest in our very first new Homegrown segment, Local Art History.
Yes, this is a little bit of history going on with this story.
It is a little bit of history going on in this story. Instead of looking at something coming up, we're going to look at something that was a little past year here to talk about a fascinating concept. Please tell us, what was VIVA?
VIVA was a teen peer organization. VIVA stands for Voices for Interpersonal Violence Alternatives. In 1996-97, I was the education coordinator for SARA, the Sexual Assault Resource Agency.
Fine organization.
Do good work. Unfortunately, necessary work. And we're still fighting the good fight that they're doing amazing work still. And I had been doing adult education, and after the third or fourth or tenth presentation, I went to my executive director, Nick Grimm, and asked her to please don't make me talk to grown-ups ever again. I know what I know. I've made up my mind. Don't confuse me with facts was a lot of the feedback I was getting. And my heart has always been working with teenagers. I was a school teacher for 10 years.
Uh-huh.
I taught children with multiple disabilities. And my favorite age group was always the middle and high school kids. Those are the ones that I got my groove on with. So I was working in education. I was starting to do education programs in the middle and high schools. And I realized that as brilliant a public speaker as I may be, I wasn't going to be half as effective getting across the messages that the kids needed to hear, as well as somebody who looked like them, mm-hmm. somebody their own age.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in conversation with the education coordinator at the Shelter for Help in Emergency, and her name was Brandy Painter at the time. So we started talking about how could we work together to compound each other's message, to reinforce each other's messages on how to deal with the issues of sexual assault, sexual harassment, and dating violence.
Mm-hmm.
And we came up with the idea of using peer education. And is that better?
Yeah.
Okay, now I'm actually talking into the mic.
Which makes sense because, you know, kids don't listen to us. Kids don't listen to you. Kids listen to other kids.
So we came up with the idea of trying to see how hard would it be to float out the concept of a peer education. I happened to be the right person in the middle of the right storm at the time because mm-hmm. I was an educator. I knew the content material about these issues. And I had two adolescent daughters at the time and therefore had access to some really cool other teenagers. And I also have a theater background. So put that all together, we...
Sort of a perfect storm of creative activism.
Wonderment, yes. So that spring of 97, we gathered our first pilot to see what kind of interest we could generate. We had 17 kids show up for a meeting, and we asked them what did they want to do to help stop dating and sexual violence among teenagers. What was their vision? How did they think they could contribute? And we had a whole list of ideas on how that might happen. And they came back to us fairly strongly by saying, we don't want to be your assistants. We don't want to be your eyes and ears in the school. We want to do something. We want to be the actors. We want to be the activists.
That's amazing.
Yeah, they really were. And we also made a conscious decision in the beginning, Brandy and I, that we weren't going to be limited to just one school source.
Uh-huh.
So by the time of the end of our tenure with Vivo, which lasted approximately 14 years, if I'm correct, we had kids from every single high school in Albemarle County and one or two from outside Albemarle County, private schools, public schools, religious schools, homeschooled kids. Were all
homeschooled kids even.
Mm-hmm, yeah. So we had we cast as wide a net as possible so that everybody could get reached wherever they might be. And I had been in a play. How I came to be actually an employee at SARA was I had been in a play called But I Said No,
mm-hmm.
which was written by Doug Grissom, the playwriting professor at the University of Virginia.
And still there.
Still there. And it was directed by Richard Warner, just recently, as of a month ago, retired professor of drama at UVA as well.
Indeed.
And he had written a play. They were going to produce it. An actor had to drop out suddenly. They were a week before their tour began, and I got a phone call saying, would you be interested? And that's as far as the phone message got, and I hung up on it and called back and said, I'm in. So I toured with that show for a year, learned the material, did some training at SARA.
But I Said No was a show about?
About sexual assault on college campuses.
Right.
Thank you.
There you go.
And so we did that. We did, I don't know, maybe 15 performances that year all around Virginia and a couple up and down the East Coast as well. We did some traveling. Some things happened in my life. I had to drop out of the show, but I went and became a part-time employee at SARA doing adult education, outreach, community outreach. And that led us to where our story has begun today.
Right. You took that experience in Viva.
So I asked the kids how they felt about maybe possibly using theater as a medium for social change, which is something I'm a huge proponent of personally. And they were all for it. We went to Doug, asked him if he could write a play that was directed more towards the issues of high school students versus college students. Could he add the element of dating violence to the content, which had initially been just sexual assault?
Mm-hmm.
And could he write it in such a way that we could get parents and school boards to let us do it? So he went back to the drawing board and wrote this beautiful play. He consulted the kids on it, made sure that the kids thought that the voices were honest and true.
Mm-hmm.
So that took about 4 or 5 months.
Right.
We hired a director. Her name was Alan Chandler.
Right. And the play is it's episodic, right? It's a series of monologues and scenes, short monologues and short scenes. For a cast of how many?
8.
Right.
So for the first year or two, we had 2 different casts because we had 16 kids who wanted to perform. Viva, through the course of all the years, we usually had approximately 30 members active, mm-hmm. sometimes a little bit more. For many years, we had 3 circulating casts that would go out and do the performance, which I'll get to that in a sec.
Mm-hmm.
But for the initial one, we had about 25 kids in Viva. Half of them wanted to perform. Half of them did not want to perform at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way we developed Viva was that there were many ways to participate and contribute, even if you weren't actually on stage. And the main way that we did this was the group discussions. The way Viva worked we would be invited into a high school, usually a sophomore class, but sometimes a freshman, sometimes the whole school, depending on whether it was a small private school or where we were going. The actors would do the play, which lasted about 30 minutes. We would break the audiences up into groups of approximately 30 or less. We would respectfully request that there be no teachers in the room, because we all know that kids will be much more honest if they know it's not going to get back to an adult that's going to come down on them. So
right.
We asked for teachers not to be in the room, and most schools honored that for us. The Viva kids had been trained really well in not only the content material, so they could answer most questions, but they were trained on how to do group discussions, how to maintain decorum throughout a group discussion.
So you turned them into peer educators, basically.
Absolutely. And also...
So not just artists, not just performers, but also peer educators as well.
Very much so.
Wow.
It was interesting. Some kids came to us to join Viva because they were actors and they needed a good gig. And this was one of the best adolescent programs around to get some good acting, some really serious work done. But others came to us because they wanted to be social activists and they wanted to put their energy behind a cause. And so the actors became activists and the activists became actors. And that's sort of how we melded. If they chose not to be an actor, they were group leaders and they led discussion groups afterwards. And there were other ways in which we did other community activities in which they also took leadership in. So that was some of the way in which all kids got to participate in order to become a Viva member. Do you want me to go into that now?
Well, let's take a moment for some station identification first. 21 minutes past the hour, you're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, and this is Homegrown, your show about local art, brought to you by Blue Moon Diner. Make sure you stay tuned afterwards for the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. Today's guest on Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call with your host, Rick Moore, Santa Claus.
Wow, you didn't sound ecstatic about that at all. Santa! It's Santa!
He votes Republican. I know he does.
Oh, how do you know that? You know what? You no.
Big old white man?
No.
Big old white man with a slave force
but
of
he's
underpaid slave force of disadvantaged people. He's
no,
so Republican.
No!
So Republican.
You cannot say that. Oh my God. Now we're going to get death threats.
As it should be. See, that's the way conservatives give death threats. That's the way it's supposed to go. All right, if you're just joining us, we are here with Jerry Shermer, former runner, former head, former organizer. What was the
coordinator.
Word? Former coordinator. Former coordinator of Viva, a program that stood for Voices for Interpersonal Violence Alternatives, formerly with SARA, the Sexual Assault Resource Agency. You've got a letter to read us.
This is something that when Viva kids would come to do their initial training, it was a mandatory 6-hour training, and then we would meet bi-monthly and either address skills on how to lead discussion groups, how to do active listening, and in case somebody should come to them with a disclosure. And I would start, this letter was written to us during our very first year, and I would start all of our training sessions with this letter. Dear Viva and Company, I want to applaud you all for being as brave to do a play on such a subject that is touchy to many people, and also to show many young victims of rape that there is help out there for them, and that people do understand the situations that they have been through. I know that there are a lot of young girls out there who are in silence because they don't think that anyone could understand, because they are scared to tell anyone in fear that no one will believe them. And to those girls who are lucky enough to never have had to experience such a horrible thing, it may have opened their eyes to how these things really happen. Most girls think that it only happens to girls walking alone in a dark alley at night or to girls who dress promiscuously, but never to them. I'm sure some of the actors saw me in the audience. I was the redhead, crying. I apologize for causing a scene, but a lot of things that were portrayed on stage were some of the things that happened to me personally. In my situation, the harassment, the name-calling, and the emotions were very real to me. Some of the kids were acting up. I wish they had listened to the actors more, because one day, without ever knowing when, they would be going through the very same thing, and I hope that they might remember some of the things that were said. I would like to thank you all for showing teenagers the truth about rape and abuse. I would like you all to know that even though many laughed and poked fun, you have caught the attention and have earned the appreciation of my friends and I. And I would say that if you have reached out to one heart, that is truly an accomplishment.
Wow. Do we know how old that person was?
She was either a freshman or a sophomore.
In high school.
In high school, in a nearby city, not within Albemarle County.
So Viva eventually ended. What happened?
Well, we were going strong for 10 years. In fact, halfway through our tenure, the high school feedback was that this stuff is coming to us too late. You need to start younger, which is what the college students had told us. You need to get to high school kids. High school kids said you need to get to middle school kids. So I went back to Doug, and he and I co-wrote a play called The Ear of the Beholder, which dealt with sexual harassment in the middle school. Basically exploring the issues that kids in middle school don't know how to express their affections or attentions towards one another. They learn from older kids who are probably doing it badly.
Because
That's how you learn. And so we talked about what the difference is between flirting and making somebody feel uncomfortable. And we had a completely different platform in terms of how we did the play. It was interactive. Those actors were also in dialogue with the audience. So these are my older kids, my most schooled kids, the kids who have basically said, you guys can go ahead and do what you want because I know you're going to do it right and I could go out and have a Coke. they would interact with the audience. They'd feed they'd take audience questions and continue the play with different skits with the audience's input. So that was a whole nother thing that we were doing as well. I retired from Sarah in 2004 with the absolute assuredness that I and the other coordinators that came from the shelter side through the course of the years had built enough structure that the organization would continue. We have 60-page handbooks for the kids. We had 60-page handbooks for the coordinators. We had handbooks on how to do the play. We had the play. We had all the support material. It lasted for, I want to say, maybe 3 years after I left, 3 to 4 years. But I think having somebody with an inroad into the theater community really helped because people were afraid of putting on a play if they weren't at all experienced in that. I took my work at Viva really, really responsibly. I was known to stop young men in grocery stores in the summer if I was short two guys for the play and say, where do you go to high school? And have you ever been interested in theater? Can I interest you? And where's your mom? You know, so I was absolutely without shame going around and making sure that I had my guys and I had
which is an admirable and yet rare quality.
A little scary perhaps. We had one guy who was in our show for 4 years. He was a schoolmate of my younger daughter, and we were doing quite a lot of ally professional conferences whenever there was a major statewide conference, which included police work and social workers and social agencies and education. We were tapped as the ones who were going to do something about adolescents. So we were going to a lot of these conferences, and my kids loved going to those conferences because adults really enjoyed what they were doing, and it was a much easier audience than other kids. And so we were having a discussion group after one of them, and one of the, I think he was an attorney and prosecutor, and he stood up and said, you know, how did you become interested in Viva? And John, without missing a beat, didn't even look at me. He said, well, I'm friends with the coordinator's daughter, and she was giving me a ride home one time, and she actually didn't let me out of the car until I agreed to join. And I'm like, John, no coercion.
Don't say that to the prosecutor.
And so I had some great kids like that with keen senses of humor, I'd like to call it.
So looking back, the effectiveness of using art for education, art for a social cause. Your thoughts? It sounds like it was very effective.
You know, Clinton, when I first began Viva, my whole concept was, how do I get this message to the most kids in a way that they are going to be most able to hear it and be able to respond to it? So my focus was always outward. I did not realize when we started what the impact was going to have on the members of who were doing the work.
Oh,
for some reason, that just sort of went over me. Of the kids who joined Viva and really internalized the messages of what we were giving out, two of the young women went on to work in the field. One worked at SARA for several years. One is still working in the field. And I don't know if you know Rachel Smith.
Uh-huh.
You know, she has worked for the shelter for many years and is now working for the Alliance. So it really, you know, touched a lot of people very deeply, who the kids doing the work. Do I have time to tell two quick anecdotes?
Yes, two quick anecdotes.
Okay, one was from a young man who was from Albemarle High School. He was only in Viva for a year. He was a great guy, kind of quiet spoken. At the end of the year, we said goodbye. He was off to Penn State to study geology, and I thought that was it. 3 years later, I got an email from him saying he was doing his thesis on the state of sexual assault education in high schools, that he was about to graduate from Penn State with a double major in geology and women's studies. So I thought that was an interesting mix of studies, and naturally warmed my heart knowing that the work that we did was important enough to him for him to take forward and give it to others. The other anecdote that I love to tell, who is a son of a major theater player in Charlottesville, his name is Andrew.
Uh-huh.
Andrew was in Viva for 3 years and wanted to play college-level lacrosse and needed to do a PG year post-high school to get the kind of attention he needed to get the scholarship he wanted to play lacrosse at college.
Right.
He went to a prep school up in Connecticut, and there was a sexual assault on campus. And Andrew said he looked around and realized that nobody knew anything at this private, Tony, insular campus.
Right.
He took his Viva handbook, marched into the headmaster's office and said, nobody knows anything on this campus, and I'd like to start that education process. And Andrew held workshops for the rest of the year using his Viva handbook and educated an entire school community by himself because it was important to do.
Wow.
So these are some of the kids. And there, you know, I've got lots of others in terms of the acting and this kind of work seminally influencing a young person making career choices. One of our graduates who was in Viva for 4 years went on to study theater at Juilliard and has been on Broadway twice now. So she's taking her early training with a magical theater teacher. Who could that be?
Who could that have been?
And has taken it forward and used, you know, some of the stuff she learned as a teenager. And so it's impacted lots of lives in lots of ways. Hopefully the red-haired girl who wrote to us wasn't the only person who felt this way, but she was the bravest one to put it to paper and send it to us.
Wow. Jerry Shermer, thank you so much for coming to see us. Thank you so much for Viva. Thank you so much for this piece of our local arts history.
You're welcome. Let's see if we can do some more Viva shows in the future.
Oh, look at you. Look at you. Not wanting to let it go. That's right, because you're the one. He's you're going to not let me out of the studio until you say
you'll direct it.
I'll hold the left arm. You hold the right arm.
No coercion here.
Yeah, we'll do it. It's fine.
So, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And they're also still doing great work at SARA.
Excellent.
Okay.
Thank you, Jerry. Let's talk about just some of the artistic things that you've got coming up in our artistic town. Currently running from now until December 24th, the 2016 Gift Forest at the Bridge PAI, still going on. A seasonal market featuring works from over 50 regional artists. Make art your holiday gift this season. Also currently running until December 24th, Manger Scene, niche installations and paintings by Pam Black, Virginia Van Horn, Lester Van Winkle, Russ Warren, and Aggie Zed. Currently running until December 30th, American Shakespeare Center's holiday season, A Christmas Carol, The Santillan Diaries, and The 12 Dates of Christmas. Catch those suckers over in Stanton at the Blackfriars Playhouse with the American Shakespeare Center. Currently running from now until December 30th, A Collage by Andrew Marriott at the Blue Moon Diner. Also currently running until January 1st, Shenandoah Fringe Festival is accepting applications for ACTS, the second annual Shenandoah Fringe Festival coming up. Submit your work in performance, visual art, and film to this curated profit-sharing arts festival. For more information, go to www.shenfringe.com. Shenfringe.com! Today, the Charlottesville Ballet presents the Nutcracker Suite at Piedmont Virginia Community College. Also, presenting it on December 22nd at Piedmont Virginia Community College. So check that out. And if you want to, and go look at our past episodes on SeavillePodcast.com to see us interviewing Emily Hartke about this year's expanded Nutcracker. January 5th, Books on Tap by the Jefferson Madison Regional Library at Champion Brewery. This month, we have Always Lived in the Castle by Shirley Jackson. It's a book and brews club. Get a copy of it at the library. And here's just some of the musical options you've got available. Today, Travis Elliott at Rapture, Jason Ring at Pro Renata Farm Brewery, Mojo Pie turns into Mojo Sweet Potato Pie from 2 to 5 p.m. at Glasshouse Winery. It's a sing-along and pie share. Bring a pie if you want to. Tomorrow, ATM unit at Rapture. December 20th, Goth Night at Cinema Taco featuring The Rain Within. And open mic night at the Ante Room. On December 21st, Sons of Bill and Friends at the Jefferson Theater. Don't want to miss that one. And December 22nd, Crank and Drank Thursday at the Anteroom with Double Faces Go-Go Band and DJ Blacko. Also, the Michael Ellswick Gathering and then J.J. Von Briesen at Fellini's. December 23rd, David Tewksbury and Friends of the Pro Renata Farm Brewery. Disco Risque holds a Risque Family Christmas. Local heavy metal funk band hijacks your favorite holiday tunes at the Southern Cafe and Music Hall. Also on December 23rd, The Musical Suspects, Turquoise Transcendence, and The Neighbors at the Anteroom, The Sound Machine Band at the Glasshouse Winery. And just in case you thought nothing was going on Christmas Eve, Bob Williamson's at Fellini's at 5:30, and Saturday Night Lights, the Christmas Eve Bash with DJ W is going on. Just remember, every Monday, it's the singer-songwriter night at the local. Every Tuesday, traditional Irish session at the Tin Whistle Irish Pub. And also the open mic night at the Anteroom. Every Wednesday, the open mic night at Pro Renata Farm Brewery. The Jazz Collective number 9 at Fellini's number 9. Quiet Fire at the Bebedero. And the Mike Rosensky and Jeff Decker Quartet at Miller's. And every Thursday, it's the John Dearth Quintet. Because every once in a while, you just gots to come down to Dearth. And if you're an artist and have an event, let us know about it so we can let people know about it. You can send it to us at our Facebook page or our email address, homegrown947@gmail.com. 38 minutes past the hour, you're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, and this is Homegrown, your show about local art, brought to you by Blue Moon Diner. Blue Moon Diner, breakfast all day, every day, with brunch on Saturdays and Sundays, and carefully constructed diner food on the afternoons and evenings. Speaking of the evenings, Blue Moon Diner provides support for local and visiting artists this week. Mojo Pie on Tuesday. Wednesday, it's Jim Wave. Thursday, Blues and Old Time with Bill Adams. And Friday, Washington, D.C.'s Help Me Helen.
All right, so we are here with our next guest, Patrick Gibson. How are you?
I'm doing well.
So you are here to talk about your newest exhibit.
Yeah, I have a gallery show in downtown Crozet. And it's all functional ceramics. I'm a studio potter. And, I'd love for you guys to come check it out. It's at the Art Box and Creative Framing.
So, all right, so I did ceramics when I was a kid because my mom got into it. But what you do is not what my mom did. Like my mom did, you know, cute little cat sculptures and stuff like that. That's not what you do.
Yeah, I'm mostly interested in creating functional ceramics. So it's something I've been interested in for a while. And, mugs, pitchers, vases, things like that. Like allowing people to take something home and have something beautiful that they can interact with every day.
So, the show is called Seeking Rhythm, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how do you seek rhythm in pottery? Like, in ceramics, how do you do that?
I chose the title of the show because it kind of serves a dual purpose. I'm a stay-at-home father. I have three kids. So literally seeking rhythm in the studio. How do I make time to work in between all the other obligations in life? But also a lot of my work is involves rhythmic movements on the wheel. So I actually decorate my pottery with slip, and then I'm using rhythmic markings into that slip on the surface of the clay.
Okay, so for those of us who don't understand pottery, so basically you've got wet clay on a wheel that's turning, and you're creating ridges in it, basically.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm referencing a lot of waves, kind of oceanic in that way, but it's really abstract, so it's really just kind of creating undulating waves on the surface of the clay.
Okay, so how did you get into pottery? Because we were talking earlier, you've done a lot of stuff. You've had a lot of different artistic things that you've done. How in the world did you get into pottery?
Well, pottery's always been kind of something I loved ever since I went to art school at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond.
Oh, yay! All right.
Go Rams.
Yes.
Actually went to pursue some work in hot glass. So I had an opportunity to do that in high school here in Charlottesville, down the McGuffey Art Center. And so I went to pursue that in a more academic setting, and wound up not being able to get into the glass shop. And what was more accessible was a ceramic studio down the hall. So I went down there and I got my hands in the clay and I just fell in love with it. And it's always been something that's been present in my life, even though my time in the studio has ebbed and flowed and then ultimately culminated in setting up a shop at my home and pursuing it on a professional level.
That is very cool. Okay, now, when my mom did ceramics, she did it in our basement, and I remember helping her. Like, she would get molds, and I would, you know, help her mix it and pour it and all of that stuff. But you don't do any of that. You work completely with just a lump of wet clay and mold it into something.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a long tradition of slip casting, which is, I think, what you're talking about. We're using plaster molds to create figurines and things, various forms. But what I'm doing is actually taking clay and throwing it on the wheel in a thousands-year-old tradition of wheel-thrown ceramics.
So so your show coming up, if someone goes to see it, what are they going to actually see?
I'm hoping you'll see something beautiful, and that's really my the thrust of my work is trying to kind of find surfaces and forms that speak on kind of a base level to people. You know, we can't all agree on what aesthetics please us entirely, but I think there's some set parameters as far as what creates something that's beautiful to the eye.
Well, and what you create is functional, so it's not just something. It's not a tchotchke. It's something that someone can use every day. So so where do you get your ideas?
It's funny because the ideas, I feel like, kind of, they kick around in my brain, and it's everything that I see every day, and all my experiences in my life are kind of distilled into my work, in not so much a literal way, but in a way where I'm sitting down to throw a series of pots, and afterwards I can sit back and have a feedback loop where I'm critiquing my own work and saying what worked about this one, what didn't work about that one, what makes this one better to me than maybe one of the others. So
yeah, okay, I get that. I'm a writer, so I kind of do the same thing. You know, if I'm working between different pieces. So how do you manage to do pottery when you have three kids at home? Like, what ages are they?
We have a 5-week-old.
Whoa!
Yeah, so we're in the thick of it right now, and it's Christmas season, so it's big go time for pottery. So luckily my wife has been willing to allow me to spend some time in the studio. But yeah, I think just it would only work insofar as having a home-based studio, so I can sneak away in that half hour between
while naps are happening.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes,
during nap time to take care of something maybe that I made or make something new. So
Okay, so what kind of finishes do you put on your stuff? Is everything glossy, or do you have some rougher textures to them?
Yeah, that's a great question. I am actually have been playing a lot with combining glossy and matte surfaces in single piece, which I think creates some visual tension. And I also appreciate the feel of a matte glaze. Glossy glazes tend to be more durable, and so we have to carefully test our matte surfaces to make sure that they're going to stand up to the test of time.
Yeah.
But there's something about holding a mug or a piece that has a matte glaze on it.
Yeah, it feels sturdier. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's almost soft. It's like satin mm-hmm. when you touch it. So it makes you want to like hold the piece more.
Okay, so you've already had a couple of shows, right?
Yeah, I did a show at City Clay, mm-hmm. which is I'm also an instructor there, so I teach wheel throwing there. Shout out to City Clay.
Cool.
you guys check it out, and you get to try pottery for yourself. But they have a gallery space there as well, so last, I think, February or March, I had a solo show there, and that was fun to have to prepare for a solo show and really create a body of work. Drives the work forward at some point when you maybe are stagnating a little bit.
And but Seeking Rhythm is having more than one showing, right? It like I was reading on a couple of websites. You've already had one showing of, or one's just passed, or coming up. Or?
Well, the showing is just for the month of December at the gallery in Crozet, but it's going to be up all month and it'll be restocked. So it's not. You don't come in and pick a piece and have to pay for it and pick it up at the end of the month. You get to take it home with you that day. So it's great for Christmas.
Oh, that's cool. Okay. And now the real question, how much is your stuff?
I try to make my things affordable while still making it a sustainable studio practice. So my mugs are $30. I think it's a good price point for a gift, especially mm-hmm. for something handmade that you can give to somebody that hopefully they would cherish for a lifetime.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I have several mugs that have been, like, passed down through, like, I have a mug that was actually my grandmother's coffee mug.
And
only a few pieces of that, like, set that she bought have survived. But, you know, every morning, I have, you know, coffee in my granny's mug. We talked about gloss and matte surfaces. Have you ever used applicants to the outside of your work?
The only application I do is the application of the slip, which is allowing me to create some texture on the surface. So it gives the surface some interest rather than having a flat visual surface. You're applying those ridges, but I've never done any sort of like appliques or there's all kinds of ways to decorate pottery.
Yeah.
You can do sprig molds. You could, you could literally draw on the surface of the clay. But I like to keep my things, my decoration spontaneous. Let's say that.
Okay. And I noticed on the website, they were talking about how you're using color, especially in this show. So why don't you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I've, growing up around pottery and seeing the traditions of the arts and crafts movement of pottery, I tried to choose a color palette that it kind of deviates from that a little bit. You see the rich cobalt blues, the dark browns and tans and oatmeal glazes of the 70s and 80s, and tried to kind of take a different path from that. So I use soft robin's egg blue. I have green celadon glaze, charcoal matte black. So a little more sophisticated, maybe. I might offend somebody by saying that, but...
No, not at all. I mean, who doesn't hate that horrible, like, green tile bathroom that your grandmother had from the 70s? Like, no, really, it's okay. Deviate from that.
Yes. So seeking a more contemporary color palette, I would say.
Cool. Okay, so what's your favorite piece in Seeking Rhythm? I know they're all your babies, but, you know, we all have that favorite child.
Well, the fun thing is that I can put my energy into all the pieces, and they may appeal to a different person for a different reason. So I wouldn't say I have specifically a favorite piece, although I do have a glaze combination that is, when I'm firing in my kiln, I do a slow cool process and actually get some crystal growth around the piece that gives it almost an atmospheric firing look. You don't quite know what's going to come out of the kiln, which is kind of rare for electric firing. When you're firing an electric kiln, oftentimes you'll get kind of a very mundane surface, very predictable, which is a positive for it, but also can be a negative. So finding glaze combinations that, you know, are a little bit surprising out of the electric kiln is always exciting. So
cool. Okay, so you mentioned before that there's actually, well, I mean, I know there's a history to pottery, but really, there, like, talk about how about the history of pottery and how you see yourself inside that history.
Yeah, this is always an interesting topic on my mind because I do feel when I sit down at the wheel that I'm carrying forward a tradition that's been around for thousands of years.
Well, you know, it's kind of like being a blacksmith. I mean, that's something that has been around for a very long time, and there's a definite way to do it. But actually, my daughter is dating a guy who has been trained to be a blacksmith. I'm like, seriously? Like, now there's a blacksmith? Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think the pendulum swings one way than the other. The Industrial Revolution really brought a huge change to the ceramic tradition. And then I think today's generation, the people who are growing up now, really have refound an interest in handmade objects, and there's a whole new generation of makers that are just being born today and are being raised in a world where, you know, how many plates you can get for $15 isn't necessarily...
Yeah, that's not a win.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, really instilling an appreciation of handmade objects and carrying that tradition forward of the maker, of the town potter.
Yeah. So, okay. So you've got 3 kids, 5 weeks, and how are the other two?
Two years old and 4 years old. So right in the mix, yeah.
Okay, so how many things have the kids broken?
Well, I have, I make some little, I call them salt dishes, but my kids use them as cracker bowls, and they've definitely broken like a dozen, maybe 14 or 15 of those. But they're fun to make, and I use them to test new glazes sometimes, so they're not necessarily meant to be around forever.
Yeah, okay, all right. So you've got a whole, like, system set up in your house, like, okay, I'm going to test this. I don't care if you break it. Go have fun.
Oh, yeah, I want the kids to have, to be able to handle and use my work, and the nice thing is that I can just go out into the studio and make some more.
Yeah, that's very cool. All right, so are the kids interested in what you do in the shop? Like, are any of them showing any interest?
Definitely, and I should probably allow my kids to play in the clay a little bit more, but you know, I have to clean up after them. So.
Right.
My 4-year-old, she's very interested. I don't think she quite understands that dad makes pottery and that not every dad does that.
But that's okay.
Yeah, that's just okay. That's her world, so that's what she knows right now, and I think hopefully down the road she'll find out that's something special.
Oh, yeah, she definitely will. I mean, my kids went through that with me doing theater and stuff like that. They just thought that was normal. They're like, oh, I'm going to rehearsal with Mom. What? That's a normal Wednesday night. Well, thank you so much, Patrick, for coming and talking to us. So give the dates and times, place, when, where, how of the show so everybody can go see it.
Great, yeah. The show is at Creative Framing and Art Box in downtown Crozet, Virginia. And it's up right now. You can go today and see it. And it will be up until the end of the month. So go check it out and get some great Christmas gifts.
There you go. Thank you so much, Patrick.
Thank you.
All right, 55 minutes past the hour. You listen to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Homegrown, your show about local art. And now it's time for the artistically local Leslie's Weekly Rant.
Thank you, Clinton. So as human beings, we need group interactions to feel connected. We need that time to feel like we have a tribe, like we belong. And as the human race has evolved, being part of a group has become very important to us. In America, we've made it an art. We advertise that we are the melting pot, a place where anyone can come and be part of the whole. And not just be part of it, but prosper in ways you can't in other places. And that is still true for lots of people who come here. But the election recently, more than a few of us are worried about whether or not America can still say that about itself. A lot of us are wondering if it applies to the people here already. I have friends that don't understand my trepidation, friends who I would and have trusted with the innermost parts of me, who can't wrap their heads around my worry. And I know why they can't. They can't because they have never known what it's like to live in my skin, this wonderful pecan tan red bone skin that I love so much. And make no mistake, I love it. I hope there isn't anyone out there who believes that my walk through America has been and probably will always be different because of it. I hope there isn't anyone who would deny the facts of the systematic racism that is to a large extent the foundation that this wonderful new world was built on. The Founding Fathers did a great job, and I'm not knocking them at all. They created a form of government that no one thought would work. They created a republic, and lots of people keep saying the republic will stand. I guess my problem with that statement is that in order for it to survive, it also has to change. It has to evolve. It has to break down and be rebuilt again. And people with my particular pigmentation or darker need to be part of the intellectual builders in a way we weren't before. Just as with Native Americans, the wrongs need to be acknowledged, apologized for, and a commitment made to dismantle systems that have placed people of color at a disadvantage since the beginning. And we were headed that way. We were on the path. There was a small light that we could see at the end of the tunnel. Just as in cartoons, I now believe it to be a train. Even though I can't see it, I have this feeling of dread that it's about to hit me. It's about to run me over, and there isn't anyone worried enough to pull me out of the way. You may say, why don't you just move? I would if I could. There is nowhere for me to go that this tunnel and train don't follow me, like my own demise looming. I don't know the answer to this. Well, that's a lie. I do. But I also know that too many people want to hang on to their piece of the American dream pie, no matter how much they recognize that someone else is sitting there with no pie at all. The American dream, this melting pot propaganda we've been spewing since our conception, doesn't hold water anymore. It's sinking. And all the bailing we can do with buckets may not save us. See, we thought it would be made of steel. And it turns out it's just painted cardboard. But that's okay, right? Because a rich white man said it would be okay. And he sold one to everyone. And that's my weekly rant.
Well, well, well said, Leslie. Absolutely well said. I'm with you. I can just that was, I love the train, because I feel it coming. I feel the tracks. I feel the vibration as it rumbling. And it's not like this nice sleek sort of maglev thing. No, it's a big old ass 19th century steam train with a huge flume plume demonically belching up brimstone coming down the track, a big old ass cow catcher with a finger pointed at you saying, it's coming, it's coming, it's coming.
Oh my. Okay, well, I didn't mean to do that. Alrighty, well, I'm going to go calm Clinton down. You guys have a great week. We want to thank our guest, Jerry Shermer, the former director of Viva, and Patrick Smith, Potterer. Go see his show, Seeking Rhythm, and we'll see you guys next week.
You've been listening to Homegrown on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. You can contact the show on Facebook by searching Homegrown Charlottesville. Be sure to tune in again next Sunday at 10 for Homegrown, only on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.